safety of the children in Gaza. May our shared prayers echo for peace and justice, weaving a tapestry of hope that goes beyond borders, embracing the shared humanity we all hold dear. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Christ in the Rubble. That was the name of the Christmas sermon we just heard from the Reverend Mother Isaac, the pastor of the landmark Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem. Reverend Isaac's church gained international attention for creating a nativity scene with the figure of baby Jesus in a keffiyeh surrounded by rubble. Over the Christmas weekend, Israel carried out raids across the West Bank, including in Bethlehem, in Jenin, Nablus, Jericho, and Ramallah. The Reverend Muntha Isaac joins us from Bethlehem, where Christmas festivities were canceled this year to mourn the more than 20,000 Palestinians killed in Gaza. Reverend, welcome to Democracy Now! I wish I could wish you happy holidays, but they are far from happy this year. I'm wondering if you can talk about the message we just heard. It was clear it was not just for your congregation in Bethlehem, not just for the occupied territories in Israel, but you were really sending out a message to the world, and particularly talking about the United States. Why you feel where we are talking to you from, where you just recently were, is so important when it comes to the almost 21,000 Palestinians dead since October 7th, since the Hamas attack on Israel.
Yeah, good morning, and thank you for having me. This was a service we held the day before Christmas for Gaza, and it was Jesus under the rubble from Bethlehem to the world. And as I said in the introduction, we are broken as Palestinians by the magnitude, the horrific killing of our people in Gaza. But I also wanted to speak not just for the people of Gaza, for all Palestinians who are appalled by the silence of the world and the dehumanization that has been taking place of the Palestinian people, especially those in Gaza. The dehumanization that allows us such atrocities to take place with the world's watching and with Gazans themselves filming their own execution. We are really tired and troubled from seeing day after day after day images of children and families being pulled from under the rubble. We can't understand how the world is okay with this. And as a pastor who regularly speaks with churches around the world, I can't understand how we can preach the gospel of love and justice while ignoring and in some cases justifying what is happening in Gaza. It's unfathomable to me and to many Palestinians. And as such, I felt the need to deliver such a message with very direct and clear language. This is not the time for soft diplomacy, especially with the genocide still happening day after day after day. And I'm grateful for those who enabled us to broadcast this service to the world. And I'm grateful that it is reaching. It's not that we're going to stop what's happening in Gaza. I wish we could. We're trying all we can through messaging and lobbying. But I hope that people will feel the weight of responsibility that they have. And I'm talking about not just Western government, many churches, they have enabled what is happening right now in Gaza. And I felt we need to send this message.
Well, Reverend Isaac, you mentioned that you were recently in the United States. You went to Washington, D.C. with a group of Christian leaders from Bethlehem. You spoke to congressional leaders, and you also delivered a message to the White House, a letter to the White House. What was your sense of how the political leaders in this country are regarding what's going on there right now with the Israeli attacks on Gaza?
We received a mixed reaction But I left there really depressed. And clearly, back then, we saw the intention and that as if everybody has given to the idea that this war is going to last for long. I left with several impressions. A lot of it has to do with how unwilling to even have a good conversation. Some congressmen, I'm talking about their staff, are willing, you know, to do. I mean, you share from the heart of our suffering and pain, and then you just get the response, well, Congressman so-and-so or Senator so-and-so has made it clear that this war wants to continue. And they speak with so much distance from the fact and also almost with lack of empathy whatsoever. When we met in the State Department and the White House, to be honest, you know, they understand the details of what's happening. When I told them that this war is definitely not bringing any results other than killing innocent people, you know, they seem to agree, but they seem to have, as I said, given to the idea that this war must continue. And I was, you know, I challenged them. How do you allow such a government in Israel, such leaders, to drive you into committing a genocide? I can't understand it, especially with some of the quote-unquote ideals many of these American politicians keep bragging about or calling for. Yet when it comes to the Palestinians, it seems no one is willing to extend these human rights and international you know, principles to us.
And could you lay out the significance of Palestine for the Christian faith? It's not only the birthplace of Christianity, but also the site of several key events described in the Old and New Testaments.
Yeah, Palestine is where it all started. And in addition to the sites themselves that church fathers have called the fifth gospel, meaning that the geography speaks about what happened here over the years, I think we have to realize that Palestine is also hosts the oldest Christian tradition in the world. Christianity started here and never ceased to exist here. So not only is this the land where it all started, this is the land that continued to witness nonstop and give the Christian message. We always emphasize that Palestine without the witness of its people is means nothing. And I hate to see Palestine one day turn into a museum of holy sites for these Western pilgrims who come and visit only interested in certain sites that relate to the scriptures without acknowledging the presence of people, without acknowledging the presence of a church that has long carried the Christian witness in Palestine for 2,000 years. But sadly, we continue to be ignored. And I think even Palestine, apart from being the destination for pilgrimage, is somehow, you know, people view the biblical land as somehow a mythical land, a land from another universe. You know, we just celebrated Christmas and millions sang about Bethlehem and read about Bethlehem. I wonder if they know that Bethlehem is a real city in Palestine with people, with a long cry for justice. But it seems that, you know, for some reason, people don't make that connection and are not as much concerned with the plights of Palestinian Christians and even Middle Eastern Christians.
Reverend Isaac, can you describe for us, half of our audience is television, they see the nativity scene, half is radio, they cannot see it. Can you describe the nativity scene that was right next to you as you delivered your Christmas sermon? Describe it in detail and why you chose to do this year as Christmas celebrations were canceled in your city of Bethlehem.
So we created this nativity scene earlier this month, in the beginning of the Advent season, from rubble, bricks that resemble a destroyed house. So it's a pile of bricks that resemble a house that was bombed. And on top of it, surrounded by bricks, we had baby Jesus. And the characters in the usually in the manger, the shepherds and the magi's are all outside surrounding the rubble, watching in as if they're looking for any sign of life, looking for Jesus. And we're sending a message that Jesus is under the rubble. We created it because this is what Christmas looks like in Palestine today. But we created it because, you know, there is a strong message we wanted to send from it, which is that in a time when the world continues to justify and rationalize the killing of our children, we see the image of Jesus in every child pulled from under the rubble. These have been very difficult times for us as Palestinians. We ask difficult questions, including where is God in the midst of suffering? And I have been saying God is under the rubble. God is with those who suffer. God suffers with us. So with the Christmas coming and with Christmas coming, the connection to me was natural. Jesus as a baby who survived a massacre, Jesus as a baby who became a refugee with his family to Egypt, identifies with us in our suffering. He was born with the marginalized. So the connection was natural, and we created this manger to send a message to the world. This is what Christmas means to us as Palestinians. It was a message to our people. I know that everyone saw it in the international media and it resonated with, I mean, it created maybe a shock to many. But for the Palestinians, it sent a very strong message. And many, many Palestinians reached out to us, to our church and to myself, thanking us for explaining the true meaning of Christmas, for sending a message of comfort and hope in the midst of very, very difficult times. And so I spoke even in my sermon that this manger somehow resembles our resilience as Palestinians. From the midst of destruction, we will rise. And I'm convinced of that. It sounds so dark right now. We're traumatized. I mean, honestly, we're traumatized as a people, and I can't even think of the people of Gaza. But I know that we will rise, and I'm pleased that this manger was able to bring a small sense of hope to our people, but that it also sent a powerful message to the world about reality in Palestine. This is what Christmas is in Palestine. Displaced families, destroyed homes, and children under the rubble.
Reverend Munther Isaac, I want to thank you for being with us, Palestinian Christian theologian, pastor at the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem. He titled his Christmas sermon, Christ in the Rubble, a Liturgy of Lament. When we come back, we look at how a growing number of U.S. labor unions are calling for a Gaza ceasefire. Back in a minute.
Oh, little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. Above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go by. Yet in thy dark street shineth the everlasting light. The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight.
A Little Town of Bethlehem, performed by Nat King Cole. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at the growing pressure from the U.S. labor movement on President Biden to demand a ceasefire in the U.S.-backed Israeli assault on Gaza. Unions helped organize a march to AIPAC headquarters here in New York last Thursday that called on lawmakers to stop taking campaign money from pro-Israel lobbyists. This is United Auto Workers President Sean Fain speaking alongside progressive Congress members at a news conference Thursday on Capitol Hill.
We cannot bomb our way to peace.
That's right. No.
The only path forward is to build peace and social justice. It's through a ceasefire. As union members, we know we must fight for all workers and suffering people around the world. We must fight for humanity. That means we must restore people's basic rights and allow water, food,
yes.
fuel.
Right, that's right.
Humanitarian aid to enter Gaza.
For more, we're joined by two guests in Washington. Bill Fletcher, longtime trade unionist, co-founder of the Ukrainian Solidarity Network, member of the editorial board of The Nation, where his latest piece is headlined Gaza, Biden, and a Path Forward. And in Chicago, we're joined by Jeff Shirky. He is a labor historian, journalist, union activist, and assistant professor at the School of Labor Studies, SUNY Empire State University in New York City. His latest piece for Jewish Currents is The Problem of the Unionized War Machine. His recent articles for In These Times, the AFL-CIO squashed a council's ceasefire resolution. What does it say about labor right now? And the labor movement's history of backing Israel and the changing climate amidst the war on Gaza, which was also published in Jacobin magazine under the headline, U.S. Labor Should Act Boldly and Choose Solidarity with Palestine. Welcome you both to Democracy Now! Jeff Shirky, let's begin with you. If you can just go through the labor unions, everyone from the United Postal Workers Union to the powerhouse UAW, United Auto Workers, and talk about the Gaza activism that we're seeing today.
Well, good morning, and thank you for having me. Since October, scores and scores of unions and labor bodies at the local, state, regional, and national level have been calling for a ceasefire. There's a statement, a U.S. labor movement call for a ceasefire. It also includes a call for restoring food, fuel, water, electricity to Gaza, and a call for the release of all hostages that was started around October 17th by the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers, UE, which is a relatively small but historically very progressive trade union here in the United States. So UE, along with United Food and Commercial Workers, UFCW Local 3000, started this petition with the ceasefire call and asked or called on other unions to sign on to it. And so far, as I said, I've lost count how many have signed on to it. And other unions have also issued their own statements and resolutions calling for a ceasefire. So these are unions of teachers and academic workers, healthcare workers, roofers, painters, dock workers.
Can you list some of the unions like the UAW?
Certainly. So I mentioned the United Electrical Workers, the American Postal Workers Union, United Auto Workers, 1199 SEIU, which is the largest healthcare union in the country, the National Nurses United, International Longshore and Warehouse Union, Local 10. The Chicago Teachers Union, the Boston Teachers Union, several locals of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and on and on. It would take a long time, but these represent millions of working people across the country, and I think it's an illustration of the fact that, as the polls consistently show, a majority of people in this country support calls for a ceasefire. And when you're talking about a majority of people in this country, you're talking about working class people, and when they have organizations like unions that represent their voices, that give them a democratic say, then you're going to see those organizations, those unions, express the stance of working class people, which in this case is a call for an end to the slaughter and for a ceasefire.
But Jeff, we still have a considerable number of the national unions, obviously, who are not taking that stand. And you've explained in prior articles the role of the AFL-CIO in for decades and decades, basically supporting U.S. imperial projects around the world. And you've written about this guy, Jay Lovestone, who was a former communist who played a major role in getting the AFL-CIO united with CIA and imperialist ventures. I'm wondering if you could talk about some of our younger viewers and listeners who may not never have heard of Jay Lovestone.
Yeah, there is a really kind of unfortunate and ugly history of the U.S. labor officialdom, including the AFL-CIO in particular, working hand-in-hand with the U.S. foreign policy apparatus, especially during the Cold War decades, roughly 1940s to 1990s, working with the State Department, the CIA, and other entities of the federal government to try to undermine unions in foreign countries, particularly more left-wing unions, anti-imperialist unions, and divide labor movements. Jay Lovestone, for many years, was the director of the AFL-CIO's International Affairs Department. He was a CIA agent as well. There's a long history to that, but particularly when it comes to Israel and Zionism, there's a long history there as well of U.S. labor officialdom being one of the strongest supporters in the U.S. of the Zionist movement going back as far as 1917, and being strongly supportive of the State of Israel, not just vocal support or political support, but also material support, with millions and millions of dollars from U.S. unions donated to first early Zionist settlements before the State of Israel, and then to the State of Israel for housing, for healthcare clinics, for community centers, sports stadiums. So throughout the 1950s and 60s, in the early decades of Israel, many of these kinds of public facilities bore the names of famous U.S. labor leaders like Walter Reuther, George Meany, Jimmy Hoffa, you know, orphanages and sports stadiums named after U.S. labor leaders because of this material support. There's also State of Israel bonds, which U.S. unions have been among the top purchasers of for many decades. This is money that U.S. unions put, dues or pension money or healthcare fund money from unions directly invested into the State of Israel for infrastructure projects.
Specifically about those Israeli bonds, I remember back in the 1980s attending a fundraiser of the Philadelphia unions for the Israeli Labor Federation. And one of the leaders got up there at that time and said, "We invest millions of dollars in Israeli bonds from our pension fund. My members sometimes tell me that they don't give us a good a return, but I tell them this is the right thing to do." So many union members do not know that their funds were being invested in Israeli bonds for decades.
Yes, and there has been also a kind of slowly but surely a movement from the rank and file over many decades to try to push back against that. Going back 50 years ago in 1973, Arab American auto workers in Detroit, who were members of the United Auto Workers, staged a wildcat strike at the Dodge Main Assembly Plant to protest the UAW leadership's decision to purchase $785,000 in State of Israel bonds, and called on UAW leaders to divest. And so over the last 20 years or so, there's been the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement led by Palestinians, including Palestinian trade unions. And some unions in the U.S. have tried to endorse BDS and talk about how their own funds, their own dues and pension funds, how they're invested in Israel. So that's one of the significant things, I think, about the UAW's recent call for a ceasefire. They also created a new working group called the Divestment and Just Transition Working Group that's going to look into the UAW's own investments in Israel and talk about potentially divesting, as well as talking about, when they say just transition, they're talking about in the arms industry, because the UAW represents thousands of workers in U.S. weapons factories, weapons that are being sent to Israel. And if we want to talk about shutting down those factories, we also have to talk about what happens to the people who work there, who are union members. And so just transition is similar to the same idea of what happens to fossil fuel workers as we transition to a green economy, making sure, and this goes back to an earlier, in the 1970s, 80s, calls for economic conversion, or conversion from a wartime economy to peacetime economy. So the fact that the UAW's new leadership under President Sean Fain has committed to trying to work towards these goals, I think, is probably even more significant than the calls for a ceasefire, because after all, ceasefire is sort of the bare minimum here.
Bill Fletcher, I wanted to bring you into this conversation. You're on the editorial board of The Nation, your new piece, Gaza, Biden, and a Path Forward. And you wrote for In These Times, the fascist movement's biggest threat, labor unions. Can you talk about what you mean?
Amy Wan, thank you for having me on the program. I just want to say one thing before getting into that question. The U.S. trade union movement has always been divided on international affairs. I mean, going back to the Spanish-American War, going to the Spanish Civil War, going to the Vietnam War, Central America, South Africa. What has been a generally consolidated position, going to your point, Juan, is that at the level of the national leadership of the AFL-CIO and most unions, they've been largely in lockstep with U.S. foreign policy, but not always. Now, what's different is that when it comes to Israel and Palestine, up until fairly recently, at the national level, there's almost no discussion about alternative views as opposed to supporting Israel. And so that's what's changing, which is really, really important to emphasize. And one of the things, Amy, to your question, is that there is great fear within the union movement about what's going to happen in November 2024. And what will happen in terms of whether Biden or whoever gets elected. And so with the October 7th, the Hamas attack and the Israeli genocide following that, the union movement has been in a tailspin as to how to respond. And part of that response is to go back to its general position of supporting anything that Israel does. Another position is that of silence. And then the growing position, which we're now seeing, that's represented by the APW, UAW, NNU, and others, is to take a critical position on the views on the policy of the United States and of Israel. And that's where we should have hope.
And what about President Biden, Bill Fletcher? I mean, you have this really interesting discussion going on right now as we move into the presidential election year. Look at Michigan, huge Arab American community and Dearborn, you know, United Auto Workers, so powerful. And it looks like, to say the least, he is one of the most powerful supporters of unions when it comes to presidents. Arab American community Yes. is enraged, the Palestinian community of Michigan.
Well, and they should be. And the rest of us should be. I mean, as you said, I mean, Biden is probably the most pro-labor president that we've had in decades. But the thing about his response to Gaza, which is one of the reasons I think that he really should step aside, and there should be another candidate for president on a Democratic slate, is that Biden is fundamentally a Zionist. He believes this stuff. I mean, this is not just the sort of the kind of opportunism that we saw with Obama, who I don't think was a Zionist, but for very opportunistic reasons was prepared to align himself with supporting Israel on so many things. I think Biden actually believes this. And his embrace of Netanyahu, this defies politics, it defies reality, it defies humanity, that he cannot look at what's happening and even at the level of pragmatic politics say, wait a minute, hold on, let's reevaluate the situation, and at best calls for greater humanitarian aid to the Palestinians. This is unacceptable, and I think that's why it's really important to right now hammer the administration around Palestine.
We're going to have to leave it there, Bill, but we're going to continue the discussion and post online at democracynow.org. Bill Fletcher, longtime trade unionist, member of the nation's editorial board, and Jeff Shirky, labor historian, journalist. We'll link to all of your pieces. A very happy birthday to Narmeen Maria. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m.
Hey, do you want to know about up-and-coming artists, albums, and more? Well, I have the perfect show for you. Come hang out with me at Raccoon City every Tuesday from 12 to 1. Hope to see you there.
The staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you a jolly, merry, happy, joyful, fantastic, exciting, fancy, magnificent, remarkable, special, white, sparkling, terrific, stunning, festive, and wonderful holiday season.
You're listening.